From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the anxieties of family life in the 90s. Journalist Richard Louvre traveled around the country speaking with parents, children, and educators about the pressures facing families today. Actor Joe Morton stayed away from TV for years because he didn't want to get stuck with stereotypical black roles. Coming up, Morton tells us how he landed a role written for a white Italian on the ABC series Equal Justice. The series returns this week. And A-line dresses and stirrup pants are coming back, and commentator Maureen Corrigan can't understand why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Less than 48 hours before Secretary of State James Baker is scheduled to meet with Iraq's foreign minister in Geneva, U.S. officials have confirmed reports that some Iraqi helicopters defected to Saudi Arabia. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Late this afternoon, unconfirmed reports from the Persian Gulf said that four Iraqi aircraft had defected. Some reports said the aircraft were planes, others said they were helicopters. Early this evening, an official Defense Department spokesman here in Washington said the aircraft were in fact helicopters, six to be exact. He said all six helicopters landed in Saudi territory late Monday night, Saudi time. According to the Defense Department, four of the craft landed at a base near Saudi Arabia's border with Kuwait, while two others landed in the Saudi desert after running out of fuel. According to the official Iraqi news agency, Iraq's information minister has denied the defections, saying Iraq didn't even conduct air exercises today. In Washington, this is Vicky O'Hara.
The State Department is expressing renewed concern about the possibility of a terrorist campaign against American targets if the United States attacks Iraq. George Getter reports from the State Department.
Ever since Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, the State Department says there have been repeated examples of planning for terrorist activities against American interests. As part of the planning, officials say terrorists have been spotted staking out U.S. embassies and other American facilities. Although officials are vague as to the countries involved, private experts see Europe as a likely location for terrorist acts. According to some estimates, there are 40 terrorist cells in Europe, perhaps as many as a dozen in Germany. In addition, Americans connected to U.S. embassies in a number of Islamic countries have either been withdrawn or given the option of departing voluntarily in recent weeks. President Bush has said he would hold President Saddam Hussein personally responsible for any Iraqi-sponsored terrorist attacks on a U.S. facility. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Defense Secretary Richard Cheney has canceled the Navy's A-12 stealth fighter program. The program to build the carrier-based jet had been projected to cost as much as $57 billion for 620 airplanes. It was being developed jointly by General Dynamics and McDonnell Douglas. The two companies were reported to be running more than $1 billion over their $4.7 billion development budget, and the plane still hasn't been built. Cheney said that continuing the program would have amounted to a bailout for the contractors, and he decided a bailout would not have been in the national interest. The stock market fell sharply today on Wall Street. Analysts blamed uncertainties in the Persian Gulf as well as worries about the domestic banking system. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 43 points to close at 2,522.77. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many parents who work find themselves so squeezed for time, they're constantly exhausted and always feel they're not spending enough time with their children. My guest Richard Louvre is up against this in his own family. He's a columnist for the San Diego Union. His wife is a nurse. They have two kids, age 9 and 3. Louvre wanted to see how other families were dealing with the anxieties of contemporary family life. So over the course of 3 years, he traveled the country interviewing parents, children, and educators. His new book is called Childhood's Future, Listening to the American Family. I asked Louvre to compare himself as a parent to the way he remembers his parents bringing him up.
First, I'm a lot more involved with my kids' life than my father was. But I think my family struggles a lot more with the issue of time than my family that I grew up with did. The studies have shown that leisure time and time with family has dropped about 38-40% in the last 25 years. And that one study done in Pittsburgh showed that the average parent spends about 30 seconds in meaningful conversation with their child a day and about 4 minutes with their spouse. I thought that was kind of a ridiculous figure until I started timing myself and realized that it wasn't too far off the mark. And by meaningful conversation, that's different than just being in the house. So I think this issue of time is probably the most important difference. Also, the element of fear that I feel as a parent and many, many parents feel about what can happen to their kid out there. I think that's really changed the texture of childhood.
Well, let's start with time. You probably found this complaint, not having enough time, expressed by a lot of the parents who you spoke to around the country.
One single parent told me that, I'll read you what she said. She says, "When I'm cooking dinner, my daughter sits on the counter next to the microwave and we talk. When she's in the tub, I'll jump in and join her. And when I vacuum the house, I put her on the vacuum. She likes to ride the vacuum, and that's a time when we can talk. She never does only one thing with her child. She grabs any available talking time." I heard parent after parent describe this kind of, I came to think of these as time tricks that families play in order to get any good time with their kids. One of the things I found is that children and parents hate this phrase, quality time. One high school senior told me that she liked the time she spent better with her parents before they started calling it quality time. But again, as I said, parents also don't like that phrase.
Why not?
Well, it feels packaged. It feels like something they have to do. It feels like a should. It lacks the spontaneity.
Turns time with your children into a trend.
That's right. It's part of the programming of childhood now. Everything has got to be organized and programmed. The less time we have with our children, the more likely it is, A, that we'll be afraid about their safety. The farther out of our control they are, we drive them far across town now to the doctor. We bus them to schools that are far away. We commute to jobs that are farther away than perhaps our parents did. So the more out of reach the parents feel that their children are, the more they have this sense of fear. I think this anxiety about what's happening to your child when he or she is outside of your control when you're at work is probably going to be one of the mental health issues of the 90s. I think it affects us as parents in ways that we don't even fully understand.
It means that there are a lot of other authority figures in the children's lives, too, even before they start school. You know, there's the people from the daycare center or even a nanny if you have care at home.
And a lot of these are commercial relationships. We have to remember that. We can have the best nanny or best daycare in the world, but, you know, the daycare providers that I would interview brought this issue up. They said, look, we're hired help here. We can come and go. Parents need to remember that this is a commercial relationship.
You know, before we get any further, I think we really need to acknowledge that the difficulties parents face really depends on the economic class that they're in, and that every economic class has a slightly different set of problems.
I think that's true, but on the other hand, I was surprised as I went around the country, and I went into very poor neighborhoods and very affluent neighborhoods, and I was surprised that many of the same themes would come up that transcended geographic or economic boundaries. The kids in the wealthy schools talked with the same sense of despair often about their missing their parents, that their parents aren't in their lives very much, as did the kids in some of the poor schools. Now, obviously, you know, a child growing up, as I've visited North Philadelphia and some of the crack neighborhoods there, has a whole different set of issues that he or she is facing. But there are common themes, this fear, this lack of contact, positive contact with adults, most of all their parents.
Richard Louv is my guest, and he's written a new book, which is called Childhood's Future. He's also a columnist for the San Diego Union. I think one of the reasons why such a common complaint on the part of parents is that they don't have enough time. One of the reasons for that is because often both of the parents work, or there's only one parent with the children and they work, you know, a single parent working. What kinds of discussions did you have with people about the conflicting demands of work and home? What are some of the typical examples people gave you of what they're up against?
One of the phrases that I heard over and over from parents is that we don't need two jobs, we need a job and a half. If only we could have a job and a half, then the stress would be less. Now, whether the husband took the half job or the wife took the half job was a different issue. But there is a sense that two jobs is just too much, and that you end up warehousing your child. You end up with very little real family life. Now, it doesn't mean that parents have a real good handle on how to deal with that. But I think there's a growing sense that obviously two-career families are going to continue and should continue, but that there needs to be a different arrangement in the workplace that has much, much more flexibility than it does now. And that flexibility has to come in a number of ways, and you know, company daycare is probably the least of the important things that have to happen in the workplace.
One of the things that you propose is that employers give all employees a few hours off a month for them to be with their children, visit children in daycare center, or
yeah,
something similar to that.
Yeah, that's what I've proposed is something I call my family ties proposal, and I originally proposed this in a column as kind of fantasy legislation that I thought the state of California should require all employers to allow all employees, not just parents, but all employees, 4 hours in which they could drop in unannounced at their daycare. Or their elder care situation, volunteer in the schools, visit the schools. The idea behind this came out of the McMartin trial in California, the daycare trial that went on for years and then resulted in very little. That proved one thing, that the courts are the worst place to police daycare. Who are the police supposed to be of daycare? Who's supposed to check on them? Well, in California, it's supposed to be every 3 years. But as it turns out, they just come in and look through the paperwork. So the idea is that parents would make the largest and most effective police force in daycare to make sure the abuse isn't happening. So allow parents to do that. Allow them to drop in unannounced. After I proposed this, I got an avalanche of mail from parents who wanted that, who wanted their company to allow them that flexibility. Again, dealing with this fear they have of what's going on with their kids outside the workplace. I got no letters at all from employers until the Southland Corporation called me. The Southland Corporation, as you know, owns every 7-Eleven in the world. And they have actually established something based on my idea, which they call their family ties benefit, in Southern California for their employees. And in fact, I was talking to them the other day, and one of the employees had in fact gone to her daycare unannounced, sat there for 4 hours, and had decided her daycare was not a safe daycare and shifted her child to another one.
You know, one of the things I like about your proposal is that you suggest that people who aren't parents get an equal amount of time off, that this shouldn't be a benefit that only helps people who are parents, that all people should have time to spend with family or their equivalent of family.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about a parents' movement, and I'm all for a parents' movement, but I don't believe that it should stop there. I think the minute we identify ourselves as parents in the workplace or politically as a special needs group, we probably will lose in the workplace and politically because we're a minority. And
really, you think of parents as being a minority now?
I think so. I can't remember the exact statistics, but it's parents are becoming have become a much smaller political group since the baby boom generation was born. In the workplace, you know, if I go into my boss and say, you're losing money because I'm anxious about my child and I need more flexibility, I'm going to immediately be tracked.
Right.
Whether I'm a mommy or whether I'm a daddy, I'm going to get on the mommy or daddy track if I do that alone. But if I do that with other non-parent employees who also have family needs, then my chances of winning that in the workplace grow substantially. You know, not all of us have kids, but all of us belong to some kind of family. And, you know, one employee may not have children, but they may have a parent in an elder care.
Of course, this kind of proposal of having employers give employees about 4 hours a month, I mean, now, how would that help you, for instance? You're a freelance writer and a columnist. You probably, in a lot of ways, make your own hours, and I'm sure you're pretty hard on yourself, too, in the hours that you make. I mean, who's going to cut you a break there? You're going to give yourself the 4 hours? Do you know what I'm saying? For a lot of people, it's not even like their employer dictating that they have these conflicting demands. It's just the way their lives have worked out.
I know. Believe me, I'm dealing with that. I mean, going into the classrooms and listening to children talk about how they feel about childhood and their sense of almost abandonment certainly changed my parenting, changed who I am as a parent, made me much more aware that I've got to be my own boss. I've got to take that time. So I have, and it hasn't. I don't pretend that this is easy. In a sense, parents need to re-educate themselves. It's not natural for us to take this time, given the current economic pressures. But we do need to volunteer in our schools. We do need to limit the amount of hours we work. And we do need to demand the kind of flexibility, not just from the workplace, but from ourselves, to make that happen.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about parenting. My guest is Richard Louv. He's a columnist at the San Diego Union, and he spent about 3 years speaking with almost 3,000 parents, children, and educators for his new book, Childhood's Future, which looks at the problems facing families today. This is Fresh Air. Richard Louv is my guest, author of the new book, Childhood's Future. One of the consequences of parents working more is that often no one's home at the house when the child gets home from school. And this has been one of the reasons why there have been proposals to lengthen the school day. I wonder what you think of the proposal of lengthening the school day and also of lengthening the school year. I hear a lot about both of that right now, both of them.
I think that I have a problem with that.
With both the school year and the school day?
Yeah, that's the latest fad almost in educational thinking. How can we jam more factoids into these children? How can we wind up our little widgets and send them out to battle little Japanese widgets who spend their whole lives in institutional care? What I heard from children was the desperate need not for more institutional care, but for more family life, just the opposite of more days in school. I think the most important educational issue today is not the curriculum, is not whether kids can do the new math or the old math or whatever else has come along. The most important educational issue today is the emotional health of children. They're not going to be given that by lengthening school year. I mean, there are some benefits to that in certain neighborhoods where it's unsafe for kids to be out and on the street, and you know, it may be better for some children, but for many of them, many of the children that I talked to, it was a litany of really missing family life and missing something else too that I call dream time. This overstructuring of childhood and the idea that children have to learn computers, they have to learn so much more than what we did as children in school, that they have to be economically competitive and all that. I think that there is a lot to be said for boredom in childhood. Anyone who has made the child turn off the television and the child gets bored knows how eventually, has seen how eventually the child finally picks up a piece of paper and starts drawing or makes something out of mud or sticks or something, finally starts to use their creativity.
With what you've said about schools of not wanting to see children's lives more institutionalized, you still go on to propose that schools expand their role in the community.
This is paradoxical, but I think that we're stuck with schools playing more of a role in family life. The question is, do we want schools becoming the family for children, which for many children the schools are becoming the family, or do we want schools that invite families in which families are a part of that school and the school is part of family life?
But the thing is, if parents don't have time to spend time with their children in their own homes, how are they going to have the time to go to a school when the school becomes more of a community center? And if they did have the time, wouldn't they rather just stay home with their kids?
It's a good question. The first part of the answer is the company is going to have to allow us time to do it. And we're going to have to take time to do it. Unless one of the spouses goes home and stays there full time, the school is going to play much more of a role in the children's life. We've got a choice. We can play a greater role as parents in that school, or we can allow the school to be the family for our kids.
So tell me some more about the kind of role you'd like to see families, parents play in the school.
I'd like to see a lot more adults, whether they're parents or not, working in the schools. One of the schools that I visited in Seattle, for instance, had a senior center outside the grade school. And for 10 years, there was no interchange, virtually no interchange between the seniors and the kids, until one enterprising librarian established a senior mentor reading program. And now those seniors sit with the children with their arms around the kids and teach them to read. And the point of this story is not literacy. The point is positive adult contact. It can come in many forms. It doesn't always have to be the parents. I think that parents should be volunteering in schools more and should be encouraged to do so. A lot of teachers are actually threatened by parents volunteering in the schools. Colleges very seldom, if ever, talk about how to deal with parents. There's a feeling among some teachers that if you allow parents into the classroom, you're less than a professional. But in actuality, when teachers, in those rare occasions, are taught how to do this, they actually feel more professional because they're dealing with two generations and they know how to do it.
Richard Louv is my guest, and he's a columnist at the San Diego Union and also author of the new book, Childhood's Future, which looks at some of the problems facing families today. We've heard a lot in the past decade from politicians about family, but do you think that the government has done anything to help family situations, and what would you like to see the government doing that it's not?
No, I don't think the government has done much to help families at all. One example is single-parent families. Reagan tried to reduce the likelihood, for instance, that single-parent household would include other adults. At one point, officials even discussed reducing the level of allotments for households in which a grandparent joined the single-parent family. Even though the studies show that the presence of any other adult in the household, any other positive adult in the household, brings adolescents under control levels that are comparable to single-parent families. But because of this traditional description of what a family is, single-parent families, which are growing in number, got no help whatsoever from the Reagan administration. As to what the government's role should be in the future, first, we've got a problem, which I call the fundamental divide, which is two different groups, cultural and political groups in the country, that define family values totally differently. What I call the high-tech modernists and the nostalgic traditionalists, they're not even speaking the same language about what family values are or even what a family is. And until they begin to talk to each other and try to find a synthesis, not much is going to happen in terms of legislation. As far as what I'd like to see happen, I'd like a mix of liberal and conservative solutions at the government level. I like the conservatives' idea of increasing the tax deduction for families. This would most of all help single parents. I'd like us to move away from the idea of daycare per se and toward family centers in which family members, including grandparents, are invited in to help so that it becomes more of a link in this new web. Most of all, I think what we need to do is move toward this synthesis of traditional and new definitions of family and and not get caught up in this left versus right debate, which isn't doing families any good at all. We're in a stalemate at this point.
So you're saying that you'd like to see the definition of family broadened to what families actually are nowadays?
That's right. Children have already broadened that definition. When you talk to them, they define families as groups of people who love each other. You know, they don't talk about, you know, a family to children that has a mom and a dad and two kids that doesn't love each other, to children is not literally a family, to small children when you ask them this. So we need to broaden the definition of family and make extended families of whatever shape more viable and supported by government programs, rather than continuing with this very narrow definition of what a traditional family is, which actually only existed for a few years during the Leave It to Beaver years.
After writing this book, you and your wife decided you wanted to make some changes in the amount of time that you spent with your children. And one of the changes you write at the end of your book is that your wife, who is a nurse, cut back to 16 hours of work a week and assumed a more traditional role at home. Why was that the solution, and why was it her and not you who cut back on the number of hours devoted to work?
Well, that's, you know, like all families, we faced, or many families, we faced an economic issue. I mean, I don't think it's particularly fair or right that as a writer I make more than she does, and she's a nurse practitioner and saves lives. I write words, she saves lives. But the economic fact was that unless we wanted to sell our house and rent somewhere, then that was what we were going to have to do economically. There's also a certain amount of wiring, social wiring, that goes on no matter what words come out of our mouth politically, other voices inside of us that we grew up with are pretty loud. I'm not saying that's the ultimate or that should work for anybody or everybody. I'm saying that's what worked for us for a while. Now, I made some changes, too. I worked at home more. I did some, you know, real effort into volunteering in my son's school more, those kinds of things. But she took the brunt of it. That's beginning to change now. She's starting to go back to work more hours, and we're right now in the midst of reorganizing our life, and I'll let you know how we work it out.
Richard Louv, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Louv is a columnist for the San Diego Union and author of the new book Childhood's Future, Listening to the American Family. Next time, astronomer Carl Sagan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. ¶¶ In the film The Brother from Another Planet, actor Joe Morton played an extraterrestrial who couldn't speak. Now he plays a verbally facile prosecutor in the TV series Equal Justice, which returns this week. Coming up, Joe Morton on acting and race. And women's fashions from the early 60s are making a comeback. Commentator Maureen Corrigan tries to figure out why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State Baker said in London today that the only chance for peace is if Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein understands that the January 15th deadline is real. His comments came after a meeting with British Foreign Secretary Sir Douglas Hurd. Mark Brain of the BBC has more.
Declaring that the only real message that needed to be conveyed to Saddam Hussein was the demand that he withdraw from Kuwait, Mr. Baker was emphatic when asked about the January the 15th deadline. It was already 5 months, he said, since Iraq invaded Kuwait. There had been a 45-day pause for peace laid down in UN Resolution 678, and now there should be neither postponement nor manipulation.
We've been making the point over and over and over that this deadline is real. And the only real chance that we have for peace, in my opinion, is if Saddam Hussein begins to understand that that deadline is real and that we are serious.
Standing beside him outside his London residence, the British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd, who undertakes his own trip to the Gulf this weekend, was equally determined that there be no delay in implementing the UN resolutions.
Mark Brain of the BBC in London. According to U.S. officials, six Iraqi helicopter pilots have flown their aircraft to Saudi Arabia and want to defect. According to a U.S. military spokesman, four of the choppers flew into a Saudi airbase south of the border with Kuwait, while two others ran out of fuel and landed in the desert. It's not known how many people are now wanting to defect. The Iraqi news agency has denied these reports. In Moscow, the Soviet Defense Ministry is sending thousands of troops into seven Soviet republics to search for draft dodgers and army deserters. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The Defense Ministry says only about three-fourths of draft-age men answered its most recent military call-up. It said the widespread draft dodging creates a serious threat to the country's defense capability. Draft resistance was strongest in republics seeking political independence, such as Lithuania and Georgia, and it is these republics with strong separatist movements that are targeted by the ministry. The Defense Ministry said military commanders are ordered to find draft dodgers with the help of Army paratroop units. The announcement did not say what measures would be used to force reluctant recruits into service. The draft enforcement program is certain to fuel anti-army feelings among separatists, particularly in the Baltic republics, where Soviet army units are denounced as an occupying force. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 42 points to close at 2,522.77 in very light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The ABC TV series Equal Justice returns this week. It's a courtroom drama about a big city prosecutor's office. One of the stars is Joe Morton. His best-known film role was in John Sayles' The Brother from Another Planet, in which he played a sensitive extraterrestrial who couldn't speak. But in the films Tap and Trouble in Mind, he played tough-talking, eccentric gangsters. Now on Equal Justice, he's an aggressive prosecuting attorney. Here's Morton in the courtroom giving his summary to the jury.
This is the worst case I've ever tried. I'm sick of it. You see these two gentlemen here? That's my boss. And that is the district attorney. The guy that you vote for. He doesn't want me to say this, but I've got to tell you something. This case is out of control. It's been tried in the streets, it's been tried in the corridors, it's been tried
in the evening news, on the steps of this courthouse, but my God, there is only one place this case should be tried, and that is in this courtroom in front of you. Now, how could this happen? How?
Now, I know that the part that you got, the leading part on Equal Justice, wasn't the part that you were supposed to audition for. What part did you come in to read for?
They actually had me come in to read for a reverend who was supposed to be like an Al Sharpton type character. The situation, I don't know if you remember the pilot, was like a Bensonhurst or like a Howard Beach kind of situation. And they had a character, as I say, who was sort of an Al Sharpton. And that's the part that they wanted me to audition for. I actually did end up reading for the part, and in fact, they offered it to me. That is, they called my agent, and they made a money deal and so forth. But in the meantime, I had asked them to let me read a character named Mike Corelli, who was the chief prosecutor. And they did let me read it, but they also made it quite clear that it would probably not be very possible for me to play the role, since they didn't think they could, quote-unquote, go black with a role like that. So after the offer was made, I thought, so that was sort of said and done. And then the weekend after they offered me the Al Sharpton role, they actually asked me to come to L.A. to audition for, that is to test in front of the network, for Mike Corelli. Carter Smith and I both ended up auditioning for the same role. Carter plays my boss in the show. He plays the bureau chief, and Rogan. And we both auditioned for Corelli. He read, and then I read, then he read Rogan. Then we went in. They had us read together. And that actually sort of cinched it. They liked the two of us together. They really enjoyed the sort of dynamic that takes place between the two of us. And they knew they were going to hire us both, but they weren't sure in which role, whether it would be either Rogan or Corelli. And as it turned out, he got Rogan and I got Corelli, and we're both very happy.
Is it best to be, like, really nice about these things when you want to audition for a role, or is it best to be really aggressive about it?
It's sort of, you know, when you're in business of any sort, you have to sort of find some gray area in between. You have to obviously maintain a certain amount of respect and politeness for the people that you're working with, but at the same time, you have to make it clear and evident to them that you are sincere and earnest about what you're asking, and that it's something that you think you can do a good job in.
Now, the executive producer and director of the program, The executive producer of the program who directed the pilot,
Thomas Carter,
yeah, is black himself, and I was wondering if he was helpful to you when you wanted to read for the prosecuting.
Well, I don't really know, as I say, what went on behind the scenes after I asked him. I mean, I think he was intrigued by the question. Thomas is a very interesting young man. I mean, he is both artistically inclined as well as commercially savvy. So I think he was put into a position where he had to sort of tread a very fine line. I mean, he certainly could not make it seem as if he wanted to push this idea simply because I was black. And yet at the same time, he was obviously most interested in finding the best actor for that role, which is why I think probably Carter and I ended up auditioning for the same role. He had to think about a couple of things. He had to think about what the pilot was going to do by itself before it had been picked up as a series, and whether it would work for the pilot. And then once he made that decision, he had to think, how is this character going to work all the way down the line in terms of the series? So there was a number of things that he had to think about and consider.
When you got the part of the prosecutor, the name of the role was changed from Mike Corelli to Michael James.
That's right.
Any other changes made in the character?
No, everything else remained the same. And that was the other thing that we all, without speaking about it, agreed on. In other words, once the character went black, we didn't suddenly want him to be, you know, a jazz aficionado and start
instead of opera, right, yeah.
Exactly, which is all fine within mm-hmm. itself, except that what I was trying to do, was create yet again another alternative for the kind of black people that you might see on the screen. We're used to seeing black men in particular as bad guys or as Al Sharptons or as people in the business world who are fixated on making lots of money and wearing good clothes. And I was looking for an alternative, and this was certainly an alternative, a guy who was involved with the prosecution end of things, who was involved with opera, and who was involved with being an Italian gourmet, all of which is certainly possible in a generic Northeastern setting.
Have you ever done anything else unusual to get a role, asked for parts that weren't specified black and they were therefore
assumed
to be white?
Well, I spent actually most of my career doing exactly that.
Uh-huh.
The lawyer, again, another lawyer that I played in Good Mother, the Diane Keaton film.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only black man who showed up for that part. And when I showed up, Leonard Nimoy and I had a very long conversation about, as he put it, introducing color into his movie. And I literally presented my case, as it were, as if I had been a lawyer. And it was that particular conversation that convinced him that I should be allowed to read. And finally, we sort of became friends and he gave me the part. I think it's something that actors of color and actually even women, actresses, should spend a lot of time doing. I think that we live in a world, and certainly this business, that's based on image. And when someone writes a script or someone's deciding to direct a script or produce a script, they go at it vis-a-vis their image, who they think these people are, what their life experiences has been. And without any malice or forethought, they eliminate a great section of what might be out there. And unless you bring up the idea, I don't think in many cases they would think of it on their own. So I think it's something that actors should do as often as possible. And the reason I say women is there are lots of parts that are lawyers or doctors or whatever who don't have, let's say, a love relationship or, you know, whatever in the script that would nullify that kind of idea. And they can go in and say, you know, I read this part here and there's no reason, for instance, this part could not be played by a woman, or there's no reason this part could not be played by a Black or Chicano or an Asian. And you could even stretch it so far as to say that by someone who is of quote-unquote advanced years. I mean, I think it's something that once you bring up the idea, you might in fact get the creative wheels to spin.
Are there stock roles for Black actors that you became accustomed to seeing over the years?
Yes. I mean, I stayed away from television just because of that, because it seemed to me on TV, Black actors played one of two kinds of roles. They either played buffoons or they played really bad individuals who had no sense of conscience whatsoever. And so that seemed to be the only possibilities. And in film, at that time, I started working this business in 1968. There, not until the 70s, and in the 70s there was mostly Black exploitation, there just was nothing in between. I didn't see my particular life experience or the life experience of middle-class individuals who happened to be Black on the screen. I didn't see stories about just men and women who met, fell in love, and had children or didn't have children and had whatever problems that they had to work out. All I saw was that Black represented either someone who had to fight for proving his equality in the world or was incarcerated, mm-hmm. or was just so silly that he couldn't be taken seriously.
Did you ever audition for any of the Blaxploitation films?
Absolutely not.
You didn't want to be part of it?
No.
Actor Joe Morton is my guest. He co-stars in the TV series Equal Justice, which begins its second season this week. He also appeared in the movies Brother from Another Planet, Tap, and Trouble in Mind. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Joe Morton is my guest. Let me ask you about some of your experiences coming of age. I know you spent your early childhood on army bases in Europe. What did your father do?
My father was a captain in the army, and his duty, in fact, was to integrate the armed forces overseas. So that meant we were usually one of two Black families on an army post, which in the mid to late 1950s was probably not the most enjoyable circumstances. But at the same time, certainly a great education for both my mother and I.
What kind of education are you talking
about?
Well,
in terms of, I guess, the depth and idiosyncrasies of racism. I mean, I remember a story where I was a kid and I was selling, I don't know if you remember, I don't know how old you are, but there used to be comic books, and at the back of the comic books, you know, you could sell Christmas cards, and then depending on how many number of Christmas cards you sold, you would get a bicycle or whatever it might be. And I used to sell them on the post. And I went to one door, and I knocked on the door, and I was no more than maybe 8. And a young kid came to the door, younger than I was, and said, "Mommy, there's a nigger at the door." And my first response was absolute rage and anger. And my second response was actually that this kid was too young to know what he was talking about. He was simply repeating something that he had heard his parents say. So it was things like that sort of begin to crystallize in terms of what racism is about. The other side of the coin, of course, is I was in battles with kids on the other side of the neighborhood. That is, the only other black kid and I were in battles with them most all the time. And because of my father's training in the Army, we actually were taught how to hide weapons and move them all around the post, so in case we were in trouble, we could go and protect ourselves.
So you were taught as a child how to hide weapons?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Weapons meaning sticks and garbage can lids and slingshots and broom handles. No, not guns and knives. No, no, no. This was just to keep people away from you, not to kill anybody or hurt anybody unless they were trying to do the same to you.
How often did you have to use it?
Several times. I mean, at least three or four times a week. I mean, you know, that's the situation you find yourself in. You're living in a very explosive set of circumstances on an army post. Everybody on that post has a weapon in their home. Everybody came to that post knowing what was going on in terms of, found out what was going on in terms of integration. Everybody had real hard feelings about it one way or the other, pro and con. And the children, all of them, found themselves in the middle. Either they were repulsed by it, or they found themselves doing exactly the same thing that their parents might do if they were against the black people, or us black people, being there. The reverse, of course, was just as true. My father died when I was 10, and we came back to the United States, and I literally went from Dachau to Sugar Hill, which is 155th Street and Edgecombe Avenue. And because at the time I could speak fluent Japanese and some German, and because I had no particular regional accent from the South, and because I didn't know how to play basketball, and because I was fairly good in school, I became, as did the brother from another planet, the stranger. And I found myself just as frequently in fights with black kids in that particular neighborhood because I was still sort of the outsider. So racism really comes down to sort of cultural patterns. What I mean by that is, if you enter any particular group as the stranger, more than likely you'll be ostracized, whether you are the same skin color or not. If you are outside the norm, most people's response is fear and aggression.
I just want to get back to something you said a moment ago. You said you literally went from Dachau to Sugar Hill.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean? Were you stationed right near Dachau?
We were stationed in Dachau, yeah. That was the last place we were stationed before we came back to the States.
In the concentration camp?
Yeah, it had been converted into an army base. And so the dependent buildings were on one side of the fence, and the barracks were on the other side of the fence. And actually, at times when I was a kid, you could, because there is that sort of museum that was left there, you could actually walk into the museum and watch the tours and walk into the showers and open up the doors to the ovens and so forth. And for a kid who was at that time 9 or 10, it was sort of like a house of horrors, as opposed to what you begin to realize as you get older and you understand the depths of what happened there. So yes, we were actually stationed in Dachau. We weren't just sort of near it.
When you moved back to the States, did the knowledge you had about how to hide things you could use as weapons come in handy? Did you
No, because the shock of being now in fights with people who were my own race was so overwhelming that it just stayed just that shock. I just couldn't somehow understand or get over the fact that I was now in battles with other black kids because I was different. And so what I ended up doing was, my mother realized how difficult my first year was when we came back to the States, and so she found this military school in Newburgh, New York, and asked me, did I want to go? And I gave a rousing yes, because it was at least something that I understood on some level. And so I went to military school for 3 years, a Catholic military school, which is sounds like it's redundant, but it's not. And actually, it was probably the best thing that happened to me. It sort of was a place where I found a great deal of focus. I learned how to be very disciplined and actually began to realize that I had some verbal skills and began to use them. It was also a place to for me to overcompensate like mad, which is what I did. By the time I graduated from that school, I think I was second or third in my class, and major of the school, which is the top-ranking officer of the school, and drum major of the band. So I had a great deal of control, which is what I think I thought I needed at the time.
What got you interested in acting?
Actually, I'd been writing music while I was in high school, and when I entered college as a psychology major, and they sort of trotted us around the university to show us, you know, what the university looked like, and then they took us into the theater to show us skits of what our first year at Hofstra University might be like. And at the end of these skits, everyone left the theater, and I just sat there thinking, you know, I like to sing and I like to write music. Maybe I could be an actor. And I left the theater and walked to the registrar's office and changed all my majors from psychology to drama. And that was it.
Your first breaks were in musicals, but you moved away from musicals.
Well, it was something I never wanted to do. I mean, I'd spent 3 years training as a classical actor, wanting to do Shakespeare and the Greeks, and wanting all of that to parlay itself into dramatic roles in film. But when I came into the city in 1968, there were no such roles for black actors, and the only things that were available were things like Jimmy Shine and Big Dime Buck White or musicals. And as it turned out, I auditioned for all of them and ended up in Hair. So that sort of sent me rolling for a while. I did musicals for as long as I thought it did me some good. But to me, it seemed like it was a dead end, unless you wanted to be a song and dance man and use that as sort of the core of who you are as an entertainer. It wouldn't take me very far, and it certainly wouldn't take me to film as someone respected as a dramatic actor. So I left doing musicals and started doing regional theater, started getting back to the things I wanted to do in the first place. My idea was that your first step in any business is to get well-known within the community, within the industry itself, and then that sort of brings you to the fore or brings you up to the surface so that the rest of the world can sort of get a glimpse of what you do, and that seemed to work very well. And then after I did that for a while, I began getting auditions in film and started doing small films, and I guess the first big break was Brother from Another Planet.
Did you have any performance fantasies when you were growing up?
Yeah, whenever we came into New York, however briefly, my grandmother always used to take me to the Apollo, and very often it was to see Sammy Davis Jr., in fact. And one of my fantasies was that, you know, he would look out to the audience and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, there is a young man out here, and that if we give him some applause, he might grace us with a song." And of course, that was me, and I would always, in my fantasy, go on stage and sing and dance with Sammy Davis Jr. The closest I got to that fantasy, of course, was Tap. I didn't get to sing and dance with him, but at least we were in the same movie together, so it was sort of a dream come true.
That's right. Well, Joe Morton, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joe Morton co-stars in the ABC TV series Equal Justice, which returns this week. This is Fresh Air. For better or worse, fashions rarely disappear forever. If you wait long enough, eventually they'll come back.
Maneuverings in and about the Persian Gulf. Also, a strategic discussion about the possible use of nuclear weapons in the Persian Gulf conflict. A report on the revolution in Somalia and the failed coup attempt in Haiti. Also, rebel forces in El Salvador say they will investigate the apparent execution by rebel soldiers of two American servicemen who were shot down last Wednesday, their helicopter downed over rebel territory there. And from San Francisco, a report on the new video display terminal safety law designed to ease a growing occupational health problem.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For better or worse, fashions rarely disappear forever. If you wait long enough, eventually they'll come back. Commentator Maureen Carrigan wonders about the latest revival in women's clothing.
Here's a question for you. Marilyn Quayle, fashion champ or fashion chump? Not so easy anymore, is it? Sure, lots of us snickered at her 2 years ago when she showed up at the inauguration in her dippity-doo flip hairdo and giant pillbox hat. But over in Paris, Yves Saint Laurent must have been watching the inauguration, too. He had a flash of inspiration and called in his assistants. "Ze flip," he must have told them. "It is very important now." Soon, Saint Laurent and the other high fashion designers began churning out clothes to complement the flip. Polka dot trapeze dresses, stirrup stretch pants, patent leather mules and ballerina flats, button earrings, daisy pins, hard square handbags, lace gloves, bathing suits with boy legs, inset bra cups, and modesty panels. And yes, pillbox hats. So now, Marilyn Quayle is some kind of fashion visionary, and the rest of us are scrambling to catch up. The December issue of Vogue magazine announced a harking back to the great creative eras of the 50s and 60s. I don't get it. Celebrating the early 60s, which is the focal point of this revival, is to me like celebrating the years 1491 or 1775. Sure, things happened then, but the events that defined those decades didn't occur until a little bit later. For me and millions of other people, the swinging 60s weren't ushered in until the night of February 9th, 1964, when the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. Before then, the 60s were kind of blah, and so were the clothes people wore. For dressy occasions, most women wore the obligatory ensemble, a knee-length A-line dress with a matching buttonless coat. Jackie Kennedy somehow pulled it off, but everybody else looked like Aunt Bee on the Andy Griffith Show. Really, no woman, not even Barbie, looked younger than 40 in the early 60s. Luckily, I was spared. I spent the early 60s, in fact all of the decade, sealed in a green plaid, wool, Catholic school uniform, complete with matching green suede Oxfords, green snap-on bow tie, and a green felt cap that sort of looked like Robin Hood's with a cross instead of a feather. But the fact that I can dimly remember the stagnancy of the early 60s makes me even more puzzled about this revival than the revivals of the Victorian age, the flapper period, and the 40s that we've also witnessed in recent years. Actually, maybe the dullness of the early 60s is the very reason for the period's current popularity. Critic Frederick Jameson, who writes about the uses of the past in literature and film, says that, in a moment of exhaustion with politics, the images that are cannibalized are those of a great depoliticized era. The Persian Gulf crisis may transform more Americans into political activists again, in which case I guess there'll be a widespread nostalgia for granny dresses, Nehru jackets, and love beads. But hey, our fashion options could be even grimmer. At this very moment, Yves Saint Laurent may be having a vision of a timeless, scratchy little number in green plaid.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Dan Lachlan. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, scientist Carl Sagan turns his attention from the cosmos to look at how planet Earth could be devastated by even a small nuclear war. And playwright Christopher Durang tells us how he stopped listening to Sister Mary Ignatius and started figuring things out for himself. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.